turning the page on my agenda to get to the right item. You're going to take up item 9, review of total portfolio performance for the period ending Q3, September 30, 2023. And we have presentations from both Veris and from our staff. Are we going to go with we're going to go with Veris first? Scott, good morning. Welcome. Happy holidays. What's that?
Scott's microphone
isn't on. Oh, Scott's microphone.
Ah, looks like we're on there.
Now it's on.
Okay. Thank you. So as we do on a quarterly basis, I'm going to take you through some economic environment materials, and then I'll jump right into performance. The data in the board book is a little bit dated. It's as of 6:30, and we're in the middle of the third month of the next quarter, but I think there are still some trends that are worth pointing out. But before I get to that, I'm just going to talk about the some general observations about the economic landscape. So as you guys know, if you pay attention to risk markets, stock markets, and credit markets, et cetera, you'll know that risk markets have really just been ripping this year and are up significantly. There was a pause or a hiccup in the second quarter that we'll talk about in a minute, but since then, it's come back strong, and indexes like the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Dow are near their all-time highs. The S&P 500 is about 3 percentage points below its all-time high. It's up about 21% just on a year-to-date basis this year. And NASDAQ is up nearly 40%. Tech stock-heavy NASDAQ up nearly 40%. So a very strong market. The market is really bought into this narrative of soft landing and paying close attention to what's going on with inflation and what's going on with interest rates. And the market believes that we're although it's never happened before, we're going to enter this soft landing period, or we're in the midst of a soft landing that will continue. Inflation is moving down and is under control, and the Fed will soon start raising rates, or lowering rates, although they've given no real indication that they're going to do that. They've got a meeting this afternoon, actually, that's starting in 10 minutes, where they're going to announce what they've decided to do in their latest meeting, and the market is really thinking that they're just going to hold steady. It'll be a big surprise if they do anything but hold steady. But they're expecting through the first half of next year that they're going to reduce the Fed funds rate by 50 basis points and 100 basis points through 2024. So the market is expecting that the Fed is going to begin to lower in accordance with this sort of soft landing economic narrative. And there is economic support for that. There's the unemployment rate is remaining low. Consumers continue to spend. Inflation, it has come down and looks like, it may be under control, even though it hasn't reached the Fed's 2% target yet. But there are also things that are a little scary, longer-term things that are a little scary. You've got geopolitical tensions that the market isn't paying attention to. Obviously, Ukraine and Russia and no end in sight there. You've got China and the U.S. and global hegemony concerns. You've got Israel and Palestine hotter than it's been in quite some time. And so beyond that, you've also got real sort of macroeconomic concerns. In the U.S., you've got a federal deficit that is at 122% of GDP. Every taxpayer owes the federal government, based on that debt, about $250,000. Every citizen in the U.S. owes the federal government about $100,000. That's all got to be paid back, but it just keeps getting kicked down the road. Markets aren't really responding to that. With respect to the consumer being a strong driver of overall economic activity, and by the way, we had a record Black Friday and Black Friday weekend, but it was also a record of taking advantage of retail credit to make those purchases. So it's not like the consumer is reaching into their pocket and pulling out cash to make their expenditures. They just sort of continue to spend. And so definitely some red flags on the horizon as well, but the market doesn't seem to be paying attention to that stuff. They're more focused on the positive news and indications of this soft landing and expectations that the Fed is going to be reducing rates pretty significantly through 2024. So what does all that mean to you guys? And to me, as your advisor, it really means that markets are going to do what they're going to do. They're going to move up and down, sometimes in line with economic indicators, sometimes not. And what you have to do through all that is just set a strategic asset allocation that makes good sense to you and stick to it and not really worry about all this stuff. It's interesting. It's good cocktail chatter. I love talking to you about it. But the strategic asset allocation is what makes sense. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that through the first, I think it's May, we're going to come back to the board with an asset liability study and really focus in on the asset allocation, make sure that it's right for your risk tolerance and what you're trying to do with the portfolio. And that's something we do every 3 to 5 years, and this is the year that we've got that coming for you. I will take you to a few pages just to kind of hit home on some of the points I made on slide 9 of the first part of our board, our handout that goes into the board book. Trouble with the page numbers here. Okay. You guys actually have it as slide 11, it looks like. So the chart on the lower right-hand portion of this page, the monthly price movement, you can see there that in this is monthly inflation. You can see there it's been bouncing around quite a bit up through the end of the third quarter. September, so the last month of the third quarter was at 0.4%, still relatively high, certainly relative to where we've been lately. But those numbers for October came down to 0.2, November came down to 0.1. So the trend is down. The market is really happy with that and looks like it's responding to that. The labor market, so another area of strength. The latest unemployment print came out Friday at 3.7%, down from 3.9%. So again, kind of in line with that narrative of a soft landing, you can see here the chart again on the lower right-hand portion of the page shows that demand for labor remains higher than supply. So the labor market remains strong. Big question about whether wages will keep up with inflation and what that means for consumer health and consumer spending, but the jobs market continues to be strong. On the very next page, interestingly, so the consumer, as I mentioned, a driver of economic activity, continues to spend. You can see the savings rate over there on the lower right-hand portion of the page spiked significantly during COVID as people were getting checks in their mailboxes and not going out and spending those checks. So the savings rate spiked, has come down significantly as you would expect, but the long-term trend is down. So a question about what the savings rate means for future consumer health and consumer spending activity. And then interestingly, something that we're not really sure how it impacts things going forward because we haven't really seen this in a long time or before, and that is this notion about so much consumer wealth being tied up in their homes that they can't really access given what's going on with interest rates, right? If you think about, I don't know about you guys, but through our refinancing, we got a rate that was 2.5% for a 30-year fixed. You can imagine that we're not going to be moving for a while. And so we've got this, we've got wealth and consumers have wealth tied up in their homes, but they're not able to access it through either selling to move, selling to downgrade when they retire, selling because they need to change jobs. So there's kind of this sclerosis in the housing market that is leading to this inflexibility in sort of mobility of consumers and workers, which, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, and we're just going to kind of have to see how that plays out. In the meantime, folks are, you know, they've got a lot of value locked up in their homes, and they just can't access it. On the very next slide, you can see this excess savings is wearing off, kind of similar to the previous slide, and now it's sort of a net negative to savings, and one would imagine that would be unsustainable over the long term. Just because I think it's interesting, I'm going to show you some statistics on housing. You can see the 30-year mortgage rates on the lower left-hand portion of this page has come up significantly, although, you know, relative to long-term historical, not hugely out of whack, but compared to what people were used to, definitely higher than it has been in a long time. Existing home sales, in the middle chart, the top darker blue line is way off, just putting an exclamation point on the point I made on the previous page. And there just is really not much movement. I feel bad for the realtor market out there. They're not selling a lot of homes. And then housing affordability. So the housing prices have not budged much, but the interest rates and the what you pay for housing has really skyrocketed. And housing affordability is at sort of record lows there. I'll take you back to on what is on your all's slide 24. So, you know, one of the pretty good predictors of forthcoming recession is the shape of the yield curve. And when it's inverted, it often is followed by a recession at some delay, maybe on average, maybe a 12 to 18 month delay from when that inverted yield curve starts. You can see that we're in an inverted yield curve condition right now, looking at that chart on the lower left-hand portion of the page. At the lower line is at the end of June. The upper orange line is at the end of September. The curve has inverted even more since then. As the longer end of the curve, rates have come down. So this is kind of interesting, right? And I wonder if this is, you know, I'm always very cautious of saying it's different this time because it rarely is. But in this case, the longer term rates have come down, not because we're expecting or the market is expecting a recession. As I mentioned, the market's expecting a soft landing. It's come down because of the expectation that the Fed is going to start lowering on the short end of the curve. So instead of a recession and going through the recession and then coming back into strong economic activity, driving the long end of the curve up, you would expect this inverted yield curve to resolve itself through the short end of the curve coming down. And if that's the case, well, you know, then maybe we're in okay shape. So there's these, you know, on the classic consultant on the one hand, on the other hand, there's really sort of conflicting indicators that are giving different signals for what's to come. And then lastly, maybe second to lastly, I want to make a point about real estate on slide 49. So you guys have some REITs in your portfolio. You also have private markets, real estate. So there's kind of interesting point here, right? REITs are a daily valued asset class to access real estate exposure, right? People go in and they buy REITs on the open market. It moves the price up and down. There's high volatility in REITs. But essentially, they're holding the same or similar properties to what you're holding in your private markets portfolio, which is certainly not daily valued. So what you're seeing on this page, the chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page shows that volatility difference between REIT, the lighter bar that's negative, pretty significantly negative, and then private funds universe that are not daily valued. And you can see that the market is saying, wow, real estate is kind of awful right now. Largely that's because of the slow-moving train wreck that is office. And the valuations of the private markets haven't really caught up with that. So You know, real estate is, there's worry there. There's also opportunity to pick up the pieces after the train crash. And you can expect, I would imagine, in the intermediate term, you can expect some revaluations in your private markets portfolio to kind of match what's going on in the public market REIT sector. And then lastly, I'll take you to this page, which is this eye chart that I always like to make some points on. You can see the table on the upper left-hand portion of the page, the very top line there, the S&P 500. You go all the way over to the right on that, 11.9%. So you're at the intersection of the 10-year column and the S&P 500, 11.9%. Strong 10-year returns above the 9 to 10% that you typically see over a rolling 10-year period. So still coming out of the global financial crisis with just a little hiccup that was meaningless from a long-term market perspective that was COVID, the big dip and the big recovery. And then a couple of points there. If you stay on that column, that 10-year column, you take your eyes down to about halfway down that column to the Russell 1000 versus the Russell 2000. So this has implications to the benchmarking mismatch, the tracking error study that we're undergoing right now that I'll touch on a little bit. You can see large cap stocks at 11.6%, small cap at 6.6. That's a big divergence that you don't see through most 10-year periods. Typically, in fact, you would see a little bit of a premium for smaller cap stocks. And here you've got a 5% per year deficit. And then, interestingly and similarly, you take your eyes down to the style index part of that table, same column, Russell 1000 growth versus Russell 1000 value, 14.5% for growth, 8.4% for value. Growth has strongly outperformed value. You may have heard of the Magnificent Seven stocks that are really driving the stock market today. Those are growth stocks, tech stocks, and a lot of it is due to kind of this AI mania that's going on right now, whether it's fairly value or not, we shall see. But that big a difference over 10 years between growth and value is really uncommon as well. I think that's it. And I'll pause there, see if there are any questions before I move into performance.
Questions for Scott. John.
Scott, you mentioned earlier in your comments we had a massive debt, I think $33 trillion, that we have to pay off. My position or guess would be that we will never pay it off. It's a permanent interest charge to the budget. Under the best of circumstances, we somehow find a way to live within our means. Not on the distant horizon yet, but... Yeah, never pay it off.
No, you're right. That was a sloppy statement saying that we had to pay it off. What we ought to pay off is getting back in line with our debt as a reasonable proportion of our GDP. And at 122% now, we're as high as I think we've ever been. Back before the global financial crisis, we were at about 50% of GDP. So we're our debt to our productive capacity is relatively high. So what I meant to say was we'll need to get back down into a reasonable range.
Yes.
Thanks for that clarification.
I don't see any other questions or hands up, so
okay,
carry on.
So let's move to performance. Just taking you to the first page of the second part of the deck there. It's looks like it's your page 53. And so what you can see here is that over the last 3 months, you're pretty much flat as the net cash inflows about matched the net investment change. And so you started with $10.5 billion. You ended up with $10.6 billion. The net investment change was reflective of your 1.7% negative return over the quarter. On a year-to-date basis, so three-quarters of the way through the year, you're up due to that net investment change. As I said, it's been a pretty strong year, notwithstanding the third quarter. started at 10.2 and ended up at that same 10.6. Take you back a couple of pages just to take a quick look at one of the governance aspects of this report. You can see here that you are in line with your policy targets broadly. So good news there. And then moving to return at a very high level. So the total fund and then the three different functional sleeves. The total fund, as I mentioned, down 1.7% for the quarter, up 7.5% over the trailing one-year period. The quarter down 20 basis points relative to your policy index. As you may recall, we've been working on this notion of, is this the right policy index? There's tracking error in there. And does the benchmark make sense? Is there unexplained benchmark mismatch? So I'm going to come back to that, but the short answer is yes, and I'll come back to that after I'm done with performance. Taking you to slide 58. So I want to point out this is an interesting slide because it shows where you are on a risk-return basis relative to peers. And as we know, your portfolio is lower risk than peers with the expectation that you're going to keep up and get the returns that you need. And essentially, that's what you're seeing on this page in these charts. If you look at let's just take the three-year chart, the chart on the upper half of the page, for example, you can see your policy index is the black diamond, and the adjusted policy index that takes into account the changes that we made for how we review private markets, you know, pretty close to each other. And then the total fund a little bit below those. But from a policy perspective, you guys are those two crossing lines is the median in the peer universe. So you've got peer returns, median returns, and quite a bit lower risk than your peers. And this is largely because of the heavy amount of private markets that you've got in there. It brings the risk down. You've also got the liquidity portfolio that brings the risk down quite a bit. And at the same time, you're getting good, strong returns. So good returns, lower risk. You know, the challenge for Verus and your investment staff is to make sure that you're getting that policy index return. And we're continuing to work on that. And then let's dive into to the detail a little bit on the next few pages, and I'll finish up my performance comments and then come back to that benchmarking study that we're working on. So you can see again here the top line, 1.7 versus negative 1.5. This is on gross of fees, and I'm referencing gross of fees so we can see the performance relative to your peer group. As you would expect in a down market, you are doing well relative to your peers in the 36th percentile you can see there relative to public plans with $1 billion or more. Looking back through longer term history, not really keeping up. So your lower volatility is not is impacting the returns in a really strong growth market, which we've been in since the global financial crisis. You guys, as you can see in that first column, outperform in down markets, and so we would expect you to catch up when markets ultimately turn, as they always do. And then looking at the underlying sleeves, you can see growth there was really the driver of that 20 basis points of underperformance for the quarter. Your domestic equity managers did really well. Your international managers, not so well. And on the next page, I just want to take you to one manager on these horrible eye charts. If you look down about two-thirds of the way, you can see under the emerging market equity header, you can see TT Emerging Markets. As you know, or you may recall, we talked to you last time, as did Tim, about some organizational changes that were made. Our manager research group looked at those organizational changes and said, you know, we don't like it, but we're not concerned enough to make a call at this time to terminate. They've continued to underperform. I know Tim and his team have actually been out to CTT, and I suspect he'll report on that. But the underperformance combined with a organizational change gives us some pause, and we'll be keeping a close eye on them. So let's go back to total fund performance and talk a little bit about the benchmark mismatch. So, you know, we've been looking to identify the reasons for the underperformance for quite some time. We did the full study that showed that a lot of it was due to the timing of when we changed the index or the way that we were measuring private markets a few years ago. There was also some associated with your international active managers. But it didn't really explain everything and the noise in there that we couldn't really get our hands on. So we dove in to try and figure out if there's some benchmark problems that are just causing white noise that are leading to underperformance. And so we looked at the last year of performance relative to the benchmark and found that, sure enough, based on the way that the managers or that your portfolio is invested and the way that we're measuring the way your portfolio is invested, there's some pretty significant mismatch there over the last year. And that has led to about 100 points of difference between rolling up your manager benchmarks and your top level total fund index, which that's some pretty significant mismatch. So there's something that should be done there. We're not quite ready to come to you with a recommendation because while we did the last year and found that mismatch, you may recall that every year your benchmark changes a little bit as you move closer and closer to your functionally focused portfolio long-term allocation. And so we need to do that same analysis back through every single year, which is quite a heavy lift. We've just finished that. We're going to be reviewing the results with Tim shortly, and then we're going to bring the full analysis back to you in January with a recommendation. And the recommendation will likely be to change the policy index to be a closer match to actually how your portfolio is invested. The two biggest areas being kind of an overweight to small cap and an overweight to emerging markets were the biggest drivers of the mismatch there. So I just want to give you an update on that because we talked about it at the last meeting. Didn't want to let this meeting go by without an update, and we'll come back to you in January. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes my formal remarks.
Great. Well, thank you, Scott, and thank you for the remarks on the benchmarking. It's a perplexing problem, you know, when you're trying to analyze and try to see where the mismatch is, but not be viewed as changing the rules.
Totally.
To try to be more favorable. And I know you're not doing that, or I'm going to assume you're not doing that. It's an art form, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, we'll be able to explain everything, show you all the numbers, and help you make a decision.
I guess that's all we can ask for. Other thoughts or questions for Scott?
David? Yeah, thank you. I was wondering, with respect to private equity, there's not a good benchmark for that.
Does it make sense to split that out where we're doing in private equity and just looking at overall just real returns or percent of what we've invested and so forth and then put the other equities and so forth into a separate box?
So effectively we do that. I'm happy to take whatever comments Tim has as well. But effectively we do that by we've neutralized the performance impact of private equity on total fund performance relative to the policy index. That was a mouthful. Essentially at the total fund level, the policy index is just the actual private markets returns. So there's no variability from private markets to some other random index. So it doesn't show up in that tracking error number, or that benchmark mismatch number. So it's effectively neutralized for the total fund. Now, I think that's a good way to do it. And to be specifically responsive to your question, should we separate it out? I don't think so. You want to know what your total fund return is. That's the, you know, that's what your actuary looks at. That's what you look at relative to other metrics like peer, different peer groups and, you know, to a total fund benchmark. So I don't think you want to actually separate it out. You do want to neutralize it for that purpose. And then I think you also want to look at private markets separately unto themselves, because you're going to measure them differently. You're going to measure them against, you know, a different way of calculating return, and you're going to measure them against similar funds of that vintage year to make sure that your managers are doing what they're supposed to do. You can't do that on a quarterly basis, though. You do it on a sort of an annual basis. So, and I think that you guys are doing that. So I think you're measuring your private markets appropriately.
I fully recognize the challenge involved in that approach, because fundamentally we do not capture private markets outperformance or underperformance in this quarterly review. We capture that in the annual reviews we do with StepStone. So if you recall, StepStone was here a month ago or so, and we talked about the fact that we saw outperformance in the private equity book. It's outperformed the public markets by about 2% per year. I think if we take a look at the Verus report, we say our 10-year results with private equity are about 13%. U.S. public market is about 10% over that time period. So we are seeing that outperformance on an absolute basis. And when we think about kind of allocation-wise, if we're not doing private equity, we're doing public equity, so we see that there. It's simply not captured in this benchmarking approach on a quarterly basis. And that's a challenge that we have to be aware of.
No perfect answer.
Any other questions or thoughts for Scott? Well, thank you.
How's
Shelley Heyer doing after the second Seahawk loss?
Well, so I appreciate. So I'm from LA. So
I know. I asked about you.
I'm in a little bit more pain with my Chargers, but you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because Shelley is not a huge sports fanatic, but we definitely have sports fanatics up there, and I do love to, you know, kind of stick them a little bit.
It's always fun. Yeah, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it. All right, moving right along to Mr. Price.
All right. Wait for the presentation to come up here. And I'm going to do my best to give you a recap of the third quarter, but recognizing that we're almost done with the fourth quarter, I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview as well, so of the data we do have.
There we are. There's the memo.
Where am I pointing? This isn't working. Can you just advance it to page 3?
This is item 10. Look at the end of item 9. We're still on item 9.
Yeah, go back. Well, while we're pulling that up there, just a quick recap. This is the functional approach. So rather than measure against a total fund benchmark, this is measured against a simple target index. It's basically saying we accept some complexity, and what we're doing here is that paying off versus a simple implementation, and then we measure the functional outcomes of each one of the sub-portfolios. So the short answer or the short takeaway here is the liquidity portfolio is operating as expected. So we are all the operations are solid there. It's paying the benefit payments on a routine basis. The growth portfolio, we are seeing some lag versus a global equity benchmark there. So we can talk about some challenges embedded in that. And I think, you know, we're going to be queuing up for some more conversations over the course of 2024 in terms of we've got a long experience with a couple of these asset classes. They have not performed as expected. Do we want to change the way we approach those asset classes on a prospective basis? We're not recommending anything today. I'm just kind of giving you a little bit of a preview that when we do the asset liability study, we're going to talk about some asset classes that might, you know, be de-emphasized or go away, and some asset classes that might come in. All right. There we go. So up there on the top, this is our report card. Liquidity is all in the green, meeting expectations. And you'll notice that the duration is down to 1 year, so the managers have really taken the duration down considerably over the past quarter. The growth portfolio, it's got a trailing 5-year return of 6%. That's not really in keeping with what we'd expect. It's, you know, it's positive, obviously. We would expect higher. The story there is diversification has not worked for many years. If you are not in U.S. large cap tech stocks, everything else has lagged behind. Value has lagged behind. Global markets have lagged behind. This has been a one-trick pony kind of show for a considerable period of time. There are three asset classes that have really worked over the past 5 years, and it's been U.S. large cap growth, private equity, and private credit. And everything else has, you know, lagged considerably behind. So I think, you know, we've taken a diversified approach. We believe that's the right call long term. It has not worked for the last couple of years here. And then the risk diversifying, we're going to talk about some. We've had an ongoing dialogue about the challenges in there and not meeting expectations and some changes. I'm going to touch on those as we move through the deck here. But really quickly on the little bit deeper dive on liquidity, I think the takeaway here is you see the yield up considerably. Our yield's between 5 and 6% now. That was closer to 2% about 18 months ago. So it's a painful process to go to get to that higher yield. You see that in the muted one-year returns. But now with a higher yield flowing in there, it's much cheaper to immunize the short-term liabilities for fewer dollars today to pay those benefit payments for the next 3 years. So generally a positive story there. Growth, I want to touch on a couple of pieces here. You'll notice most everybody's in the green, meaning there's money flowing into their funds or the balances of their strategies are up, and that could be because of market movement or new money. And we also track asset growth. Generally, everybody in the green column there. TT, which Scott touched on, is down considerably. This is, we've had announcement that the portfolio manager who founded the strategy is going to be retiring roughly in the first quarter of next year. Mitch and Greg were just on site with them last week, so I've got the initial report back. We need to go through the full deep dive there. I think we are more comfortable than we were, but still quite cautious at this point in time. And then the other ones in yellow there, AQR and Panagora, these are risk parity managers. Risk parity has been a very challenging space, and it's one of those things that you put together a strategy that brings an equal risk contribution from lots of different asset classes. It pencils out great. It is not implemented well, and I think that's one of those asset classes we need to take a really hard look at next year to, is this belong in our portfolio on a going forward basis? And here, unfortunately, we see some red. You know, I want to go through the red portions there. This is our manager's performance relative to long-term expectations. So anything we're doing in the risk space, we kind of say we need to get a return similar to what's available cheaply and easily in a global equity index. And so you see at the top there the MSCI ACWI. This is a global equity index. So about 60% U.S., 30% developed markets, and 10% emerging markets, roughly. And it's had a great one-year return of 21%. It's had a pretty solid 10-year return of 8%. So most of our domestic equity managers in the green. This has been a U.S.-led market. Our international managers more in the mid-single digits, not in keeping with our long-term expectations for that asset class, but not the end of the world either. There's been a currency impact, and there's been lack of growth outside the United States. TT is a little bit different in that we have specific concerns around the team and the implementation. So you couple those two together. It's not a great starting point, which is why we did the re-underwriting and try to understand what the team dynamics are on a going forward basis. There'll be more to report on that. I literally just got the download this morning, so I want to spend some time with my team on that one, but there'll be more to come on that front. Yes?
Add to that for TT, the fees are
excess of $1 million, which is pretty significant. Yeah. So you hook up the performance with the fees, and it's not a good picture. No. So,
and we focus on the net of fee return, and it had been good. They're certainly in a stumbling position right now. We're trying to say, look at this and say, like, over the next 5 years or so, do we have conviction that they can execute? Was there something about the marketplace dynamics that kept them from executing?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we think that fundamentally the, you know, the secret sauce is not there anymore? And that's a difficult and artful question to try to answer. You are absolutely correct, though, that the higher your fee level, you know, the further you start behind and try to catch up to delivering those alphas to us as clients. So,
and they're not even the highest. Artisan, as I recall, is in excess of $2 million, something like that.
I think TT is higher on a basis point.
Okay.
But yeah. Artisan has a higher balance. Yeah. So I want to kind of put a pin on that one. We just got the information. I want to spend some more time on that one. Yes.
Is there much of a difference in
strategy between TT and PIMCO? Because PIMCO is just knocking it out of the park this year. But historically, 5 and 10 years also done a lot better. Is TT just mainly focused in Europe and PIMCO is much broader? Or what's the difference in strategy then?
Yeah, that's a great question. These are both players in global emerging markets. So they both kind of had the same starting set of opportunities to invest in. The difference being PIMCO is quantitative, so the mathematical model of trying to find the best companies. TT is very much fundamental, try to understand the companies and the currencies. That's the first difference. The second difference, which is really driving this, PIMCO is value-oriented. They're trying to find cheap stocks that they think are going to go up in value. TT is growth-oriented. They're trying to find accelerating growth stories. If we were to wind the clock back to 2019, we saw the exact opposite relationship where TT was outperforming and PIMCO was really struggling to find value to invest in. That has completely reversed here, and that's an interesting point to make. This value has not worked in the United States. Over the past year, value has started to work outside the United States, and that's you see these deviations here. PIMCO coming up dramatically relative to TT. Peerford outperforming William Blair. So the value-oriented managers are outperforming over this past one-year period outside the United States. Inside the United States, still not working. Long-term, you know, the academic models say there should be a premium associated with value. That premium has been dormant to in retreat for 15 years. A lot of that because it's thought because of the more interventionist approach from the Federal Reserve really supporting the capital markets in the United States relative to some of our other markets. I think the jury's still out on the exact explanation of what's driving that, but it is an interesting bit to note that that value orientation has come back alive everywhere except for the United States. But that is the story there. PIMCO is value, TT is growth. And so that kind of explains the bulk of the difference there.
You answered the question I had in passing by reminding us of 2019 and the sort of the reverse roles for PIMCO and TT, and I hadn't recalled what TT's prior performance was. So I think you referred to it them kind of losing the secret sauce, and it sounds like something's amiss. And you know, when you look at these numbers, it's pretty staggering, actually. The negative side of this. So, but I realize that there's more to the story. But just from the facially looking at this in a snapshot, it's sobering.
Yeah, we don't have a watch list, but we certainly have a short leash list.
Yeah.
And then I'll just comment on, you see, Voya is our high-yield manager. We think the high-yield space in general has underperformed our expectations. This should be something closer to being aligned with the equity markets, and it simply hasn't been. Over the past year, yes. Over that 5 and 10 year period, no. And then with AQR and Panagora, the two risk parity managers I mentioned, low single digits negative on a real return basis is not our expectation there. But that is indicative of the entire risk parity space right now. And then at the bottom, you know, take a look at those private markets there. Private equity, 13% over 10 years, down a little bit this past year. Private credit is the golden child in the industry and the golden child in our portfolio, high single digits, nudging towards closer to double digits. And real estate, obviously, a more difficult market environment there. Our legacy portfolio had a lot of office in it. That's going to take many years to work out. We have been, you know, more aggressive in the past 18 months about deploying capital because we think the opportunity set's going to develop, but that legacy portfolio is really lagging on us as well. And then,
I
I just want to comment on two manager updates. TPG is a large private equity firm that we're invested in. They had earlier this year announced that they intended to acquire Angelo Gordon, a smaller credit and real estate shop that we're also invested in. That deal closed on November 2nd, so Angelo Gordon is now part of TPG. Not our favorite thing in the world to see the acquisitions, but we do think that there's been somewhat of a dearth of mergers in the asset manager space. I think the time is right now. You're probably going to see a wave of that over the next 2 years, that the big want to get bigger. And scale really matters right now. And then, as I mentioned, Niall Paul is leaving TT in the next couple of months here. And so more to come on that front. On the risk diversifying, I'm not going to dwell on past performance. It's been somewhat restructured over the past year. We have Acadian under review. The firm announced in October that the lead portfolio manager, Ilya Fiegelman, was terminated along with four more junior people. We have conducted an on-site. We are getting weekly updates. Again, this would be under the short-list category. We need to see improvements in the near term. I think the individual they have leading the team right now, we think highly of, but that doesn't matter if we're not seeing it in the performance results. And so we're watching them very carefully. Yes?
Most of the churning you see is people that are retiring.
People are moving to another firm. I seldom hear you say they were terminated. Without digging into HR stuff that we don't have a right to know, what would cause someone to be terminated?
It was a wave of layoffs. There was 30 people across the firm. Five of them were on our team.
Oh. They'd probably prefer to call it a layoff than a
termination. They probably would.
Than a termination.
I view this as a termination.
Okay.
I think they wanted a change in leadership there. Yes, it was part of broader layoffs, but when you part ways with the architect of the strategy, that's not a layoff to me. That is a decision about a different direction for that team going forward.
Okay.
All right, and then the other thing I wanted to mention is we've talked about adding trend-following strategies to this risk-diversifying portfolio. My team conducted on-site reviews with both PIMCO and Brevin Howard over the past 2 weeks, and we expect to have something back in terms of a recommendation in the first quarter to add a new manager into the space. I wrap all that up. We try to maintain a spread, keep the blue line above the red line. That means more upside capture than downside capture. The spread is there. The spread is narrower than I'd like to see, but the spread is there and remains positive. And then on a risk-adjusted basis, in the middle of that page there, Sharpe ratio is still good. I won't say solid, I'll say good. But we do see some lagging on absolute returns relative to that simple target index. Some of that's a little bit of the mismatch in private equity. Some of that's underperformance. I think this is a report that should be read as, we have some issues in the portfolio. They are being addressed, but I want the board to be aware of that. That all is not perfectly rosy, but we think there's a viable path forward to correcting those pieces right now. And with that, I take any other questions from trustees.
Any other questions for Tim? I'm not seeing any, so thank you.